Well, it's a great pleasure, Jonathan, to have a chance to talk to you about your life and distinguished editorship of Anthropology Today and other things. When were you born?
I was born in 1941.
Ah, which month?
September.
Ah, you're 2 months older than me, 3 months older
right.
than me. And where was that?
It was in Calcutta.
Really? Ah, we were born very close. I was born in Shillong, nearby. So, tell me something about why you were in Calcutta and about your parents.
My father was a businessman, and we stayed in India during the war. But I spent my early years in Darjeeling in a hill station where the women and children were sent. And my father had a reserved occupation because he was running a business, and particularly jute mills and things like that, which were very important for the economy.
Did either of your parents, well, they must have had a considerable influence. Tell me something about them then.
My father was really at heart a scholar. He was an amateur botanist and a fellow of the Linnaean Society. He wrote a book on the trees of Calcutta and its neighbourhood and took the trouble to learn Hindi and Bengali, and particularly on the folklore of trees. That he was good, and his book is still in circulation in India because nobody's actually superseded it, I believe. But he wasn't quite so good on people. He was better on nature than on people, and he actually thought that both Hinduism and Islam had been a very bad thing for India, and that Christianity was the thing to promote. And they both supported something called the Oxford Mission to Calcutta, which was a high church brotherhood and sisterhood. So there were always, in my childhood, fathers and sisters from the Oxford Mission coming to stay and so on. And my mother was a devout Christian. But although I was sent back to have a rather Kipling-esque childhood in England, going to English schools, I went back to India now and then until I was about 12, and certainly the experience of seeing such a very different culture, I think, must have had an influence.
Mm. Tell me just a little more about your mother. Was she, apart from being religious, was she...?
She came from a Scottish family. Her father had been a mining engineer, going all around the world's gold mines. And she met my father. She was sent out as part of the fishing fleet, which was the young English ladies were sent out to India to try and find husbands. And after an unsuccessful episode where she didn't find a husband, she came back to England, but she met my father in Devon, and they married and spent most of their lives out there. So she was in some ways a typical mem sahib.
Many overlaps with my family, same story. So you were sent back to preparatory schools?
Well, I was sent to a boarding school at the age of 5, actually, and still if I read Kipling's story, Bar Bar Black Sheep, I find it very painful to read, although I didn't go blind, as the hero of that story does. But certainly the transition from Darjeeling at the age of 3 to an English boarding school in the very bad winter of 1947, and, you know, food shortages and so on, I think was quite painful.
Yes. So, after that school, you went to...
Then I was sent to a typical English prep school in Dorset, where one played rugger and flooded fields and so on. But it had some redeeming qualities all the same.
Mm. What was it called?
Spyway.
Spyway. Presumably you don't remember any of the teachers or people at that school.
Well, I do actually, because there was a classic, it was a small school and it became even smaller at one point because I think they were rather snobbish and they wanted to keep up the quality of the social quality of the boys, and they didn't accept quite enough boys. At one time we were down to 35, but there was an elderly classics master who I believe had been sacked from another school for misbehaving with boys in a sort of typical way, but he behaved impeccably with me, and he was like a kind of private tutor and helped me get a scholarship to Eton, which of course in those days was a bit easier than it is now, because you simply had to be pointed to the right bits of Ovid and Virgil to get through the exam.
So we'll move you on now to Eton,
yes.
Which you've written about and influenced your life quite considerably. What would you
say? I suppose it did. Well, I happen to have, I think one thing I will be remembered for will be writing the classic ethnography of corporal punishment at Eton in the 1950s, which I wrote for a journal called Child Abuse and Neglect. And this goes into all the full panoply of different kinds of corporal punishment that were common in the schools at that time. I think it all stopped in those schools long after I left, about 1968, with the film If by Lindsay Anderson, when parents suddenly realised what dreadful things were being done to their sons, and it all stopped quite suddenly.
Mm. Were there parts of Eton there that you enjoyed?
Oh yes, there were some extremely good teachers, and I was one of the last to have a real grounding in doing things like composing Latin verse, translating Kipling into Greek iambics and so on, which was stopped, like corporal punishment, very soon after I left. But I felt I was one of the last of this tradition going back to the Middle Ages. I was talking to Nicholas Allen, who had very, very similar classical education. Mm,
the anthropologist, yes.
Yes.
Were there any teachers there who especially interested or something?
Well, there was a great headmaster, Robert Burley, who was B-I-B-R-L-E-Y. Yes, he was afterward. He'd been in Germany as part of the commission to try and pacify Germany after the war, and had adopted a very enlightened approach then of wanting to promote reconciliation. And after he left Eton, he went out to South Africa, where he did rather similar work. He was a very outstanding man. I certainly remember his classes on Dante and things like that.
Were there any subjects which were beginning to appeal to you particularly at that point?
Well, not really anthropology, because it really hardly crossed my... It was mainly classic. Science was taught extremely badly, a certain amount of history, but it was mainly classics.
Did you go back to Calcutta during your time at Eton?
No, I didn't go back there since I was about the age of about 12.
Mm. So you were already just not particularly thinking of any particular topic to study, but you decided to go to university.
Eton had at that time a special affinity with King's, Cambridge, and indeed I got something called a closed scholarship, which I believe the standards were supposed to be the same as if it was an open scholarship. It was a special scholarship that only Etonians could get. I got a minor scholarship in classics, but decided not to carry it on, but to do... I wanted to read law, actually, but I was told by the senior tutor that it wasn't a proper education. And so I did English.
Was that senior tutor also an English?
Raven. John Raven.
John Raven,
yes, yes. But I then... I wanted to change, actually, to anthropology, because I got interested in anthropology at King's, and particularly in Lévi-Strauss' Tristropique, which I read, and various other books. I wanted to change halfway through, but I think at that time both Leach and Fortes were in the field, which on the whole they tried not to be in the field at the same time, but they were. And the man who was standing in said, "You can forget about all that stuff," and he pointed me to things like the TIV, you know, very long monographs, which I simply wasn't able to cope with. And so I abandoned this plan to change, went on with English, and didn't come back to anthropology for quite a time. But I had been really interested in it at that point and read quite a bit of.
What year was it that you came to Cambridge?
59.
So Leach and so on were away about 1960.
Yes, that was the time, I think, when they were away.
Mm. And who was the person who stood in?
Perhaps I should mention it was Martin Southwold, who I afterwards developed a high esteem for. But he wasn't very good at finding the hook which would get one enthused.
Mm. Were you enthused by English?
Yes, I was very much. But in fact, I was accepted for a college studentship to do a thesis, a doctoral thesis on right-wing tendencies among 20th century writers, particularly Eliot, Lawrence, Yeats, Pound, which actually a number of people wrote books about afterwards. but I abandoned it. I think I was told that it was dropped because it was refused by the faculty because I was a student of George Steiner, who was rather unpopular at that time. But that may be just a rationalization of it not being good enough. But I had some very interesting teachers like him and Raymond Williams. Mm. It was a very exciting time, actually. Mm.
Tell me something about either of those two.
Raymond Williams was, I must say, an absolutely brilliant lecturer, one of the best lecturers I've heard, I think. And I think a very inspiring man in many ways. George Steiner, in a totally different way, was a great person to be supervised by, though he was extremely strict compared with the average Cambridge supervisor. I mean, if one arrived 5 minutes late for supervision, one got a lecture. And that he was, when he said things that one remembers many, many years later, I must say.
Mm. So you nearly did a PhD, but then you decided...
Well, it was decided for me because the faculty turned it down. Now, they said I could try again and rewrite, but I decided it wasn't really for me. And Steiner said that you had to be really good to make a career in English, and I might end up with a junior lectureship in Aberystwyth for life. And so I decided to drop out.
What was King's like in those days? I mean, we heard from Geoffrey Lloyd, who was around probably then at the same time. Was it a very lively and interesting college?
Yes, it was. I made friends with Ian Forster, who lived just above my room, which is now turned into the college bar. And it was a very light. It was just at the tail end of the Bloomsbury era, I think. There were people like Sir John Shepherd prowling around the cloisters, and
yes,
and Professor Pigou, mm, and people like that.
Yes, Joan Robinson. What was Ian Forster like?
He was extraordinarily kind and approachable man. I mean, you could go into his room at any time and ask him to come down for coffee or... very, very approachable and loved young people. He was fantastic to have around. Mm.
So, instead of going on to study right-wing tendencies, what did you do?
I was completely at sea at what to do because I hadn't made any real plans. And in those days, there was no worry about unemployment or anything like that. And I decided that technology was going to be a really important thing in the future. So I took a job first with a firm that did what was called programmed learning in those days, teaching machines, which has since blossomed into computer-assisted learning. In those days it was a very ropey kind of microfilm reader, and based on Skinnerian lines of operant conditioning and so on. But it was quite interesting for a short time. Then I took a job with IBM. As a trainee systems engineer, and stuck it for 3 years. But in those days, computers were totally different. Mm. I mean, you had huge air-conditioned rooms with a computer capacity that would now fit into a laptop. Mm. And I stuck that for a time, and then I got a job for I got a job for a very short time in the City of London as an investment analyst. Mm. But I realized it wasn't really, neither things were really for me, but I got very interested in contemporary art, particularly what was fashionable at that time, high-tech art, mm, using computers and holography. Mm. And I started working for the ICA, the Institute of Contemporary Arts in London, and I had a monthly column on art and technology in Studio International, which was a monthly art journal. at that time, a very lively art journal, and the ICA was a very lively place. Mm. But after doing that for some time, I was put in charge of some lecture series at the ICA and made contact with Mary Douglas, who gave, I think, what is still regarded as a very influential lecture called Environments at Risk, mm, in a lecture series on ecology.
What date was
it? 1971. Mm. It was a series of lectures in ecology which was just beginning to become something very popular. about the same time as Friends of the Earth was founded in Britain. But she gave this lecture which was relating the pollution, as the scientists understand it, to tribal fears of pollution based on Purity and Danger.
She'd already published Purity and Danger,
and she was already getting a big reputation. The lecture hall was absolutely packed, I remember. But it was an extremely interesting lecture, and it made me realize that anthropology was the discipline to follow. Mm. And then I got to know Edmund Leach and a few other people like John Schved, the American anthropologist. S-Z-W-E-D, perhaps not so well remembered now. And I went on to edit, to organize at the ICA a mixed media program called The Body as a Medium of Expression, with anthropologists and psychologists and philosophers talking about the body from an academic point of view, but a supporting program of activities on dance and fashion and encounter groups, when people sort of form circles and tell each other how much they appreciate each other, the thing that came from California, and all that sort of thing.
Mm. But that ended up in a book.
It ended up in a book. Mm. But we did things like, there was a lecture, actually it was by this man John Schved, on race and the body. And this was, as a curtain raiser to this lecture, we had a short ballet choreographed by Richard Alston, who later became a very well-known choreographer, director of the Rumba, when a young dancer with no clothes on, a young male dancer was sort of gyrating in the stage, and there was a pot of blue paint where he put his hands and gradually smeared blue handprints all over his body. After which, poor John Sfed was expected to give an academic lecture on race and the body. It was a little bit hard on him. But that was the ICA in those days. It was quite a lively place.
Mm-hmm. Were you secretary?
I was secretary, and I helped with the administration and some of the lectures. And I also organized a French program to mark the entry of Britain into the common market in March 73. Mm. And we had some anthropologists like Dan Sperber, and also people like Roland Barthes, and other people at that time, because there was great interest in London in French anthropology.
So it was taking you back to your interest in structuralist.
Yes, a bit, I suppose, yes.
Mm. So, I forgot to ask where the IBM work was. Was that in London?
Was in London, yes. Mm. I got very interested in the whole question of artificial intelligence and computing and this sort of thing, which I later thought I had rather exaggerated their importance from a philosophical point of view, though obviously the effect on society has been enormous.
Sounds as if you were really fulfilled. So why did you stop working at the ICA?
Because I thought the ICA was devoted mainly to avant-garde contemporary art, which I thought was a bit of a dead end. In fact, I still rather do. I think you have to go up a lot of blind alleys before you find anything very interesting there. And I got very interested in anthropology, and it so happened that the RAI was at its low point. And they wanted someone, they advertised for a director. Mm. The first interview I went to, I was on the short list, but they appointed a retired colonial civil servant called Wing Commander Darling. But this was because a typical thing that happens with appointments committees, the committee couldn't agree between, I think, Peter Acker and Nicholas David, and so they chose a compromise candidate. Edmund Leach was absolutely furious and walked out in a storm, and they didn't take up the man's references. And afterwards, Jack Goody said that this was a man who'd quarrelled with every decent person in Ghana, and he was also an alcoholic. So he only lasted. I don't think so. He lasted for about 3 months.
Okay. So he was actually appointed.
He was appointed and lasted for about 3 months, and then they came to me and said, would I like to be considered again? And I said, yes.
Mm. So you were appointed.
It was quite easy starting after someone who'd been such a disaster.
This was 73?
74, yes.
Yeah. And you
but I didn't have any anthropological qualifications, so that was a little bit of a hurdle to start with.
Yes. I mean, did you ever, this could come later, but did you ever do what anthropologists are supposed to do, which is to go and spend time, a lengthy period of time in some other culture?
Not really, no. Short periods, but never proper field work. I think actually this may go back to my early schooling, that I suffer intensely from homesickness, and I don't think I could do the sort of field work that people do for a year or 18 months. I think I'd rather leave that to others.
Mm, that's interesting. Interesting revelation. I mean, you might have been the case that having spent a very early period in India, you might have wanted to go back and...
Yeah, I think thinking back in Calcutta, it was sort of golden years, I remember, but on the other hand, extremely racist, the whole attitude in Calcutta. I remember things like the swimming club, which was for Europeans only,
yes.
Tolly Gunge Club, yes. Likewise, all these things.
Mm.
And I think I preferred it to remain a memory rather than go back to it. I'm sure India is probably the most interesting country ethnographically in the world, with all the complexities of culture and politics and so on.
Mm. Did you remember the poverty?
Very much, yes. I remember my father saying rather brutally when I asked a question about beggars, this was after independence, he said, well, they're independent now, they can look after their own beggars.
Mm.
And also in a car being driven by a driver and, you know, little hands trying to get through the windscreen and him rolling it up. I mean, that was a very early memory.
Mm.
And one day I went off, when I was about 10, I suppose, I went out of the house for a walk by myself in the suburb of Alipore along a canal, and there was absolute hell raised by my father when I came back that the servants had allowed me to go out on my own.
Mm. nothing happened to you?
Nothing happened. In fact, I remember it as an early sign of independence beginning to set in. My independence.
To come back to anthropology today.
Yes.
Can you give a sort of overview of your time there? Because it was quite a long period, and any major sort of...
Well, it's. I suppose it can be divided into periods of the RAI's offices, because to begin with it was in a very dreary building in Craven Street. An 18th century house where I believe Benjamin Franklin had once lived, but it was a rather depressing place to work. And we managed to get out of that in about 3 or 4 years, and for 10 years rented rooms with the Royal Asiatic Society, who had a beautiful house in Queen Anne Street.
Mm.
And we rented the front two rooms and were able to use the other rooms for meetings.
Mm.
But their lease ran out, and they found new premises after 10 years, and we were able to get the premises in Fitzroy Street, where the REI still is, which is not ideal, because there was no room for the library, which has now gone to the British Museum, an excellent solution for it. But it was an improvement on the others, and the REI now has its own freehold.
Yes.
But another way of looking at it from the point of view of periods was the first... 12 years, I think it was, of RAIN, the Royal Anthropological Institute News,
mm.
which then managed to mature into Anthropology Today in 1986. And that was with great encouragement from Edmund Leach. I think it might easily not have happened, or would have happened much later,
mm.
if it hadn't been for his far-sightedness, really, in standing up to some of the more conservative members of the council,
mm.
who really thought it was... rather trivial thing to be doing.
Yes. What about the theoretical framework of anthropology over that period? I mean, were there periods, did you sense large changes over that?
Yes, I did. Actually, I wrote about this in the introduction to an anthology called The Best of Anthropology Today, of some of the the key changes. I think one of the biggest changes was what one could call the crisis of representation, because if one thinks of the changes that were made by people like Foucault, Edward Said, John Berger, making people think about representations and the influence of the mass media, for instance, I think it separates off the older generation anthropologists who never understood this from the younger generation. And perhaps that's correlated with the rise of feminism and the understanding of gender, because there is an analogy. If one thinks about the feminization of colonized peoples, that they are both made out to be very glamorous and romantic, at the same time depreciated. So I think there's an analogy between the rise of feminism and the understanding of representations. And if one takes a sort of dramatic example of this, it could be the confrontation between Edward Said and Ernest Gellner. Yes. Because Edward Said wrote this book on cultural and imperialism.
The second, which
Gellner savaged in the Times Literary Supplement. And there was then an exchange of letters between Said and Gellner, in which I intervened. I sent a short letter because Said accused Gellner of being anti-Muslim, which I said that I'd read almost everything that Gellner had written, and I couldn't see any evidence for this at all. He was a rationalist with regard to religion in general, but certainly not anti-Muslim. And I said that Said ought to retract, because it was a very damaging thing to say about someone who was an expert on the Muslim world, and for that matter the president of the RAI. But he didn't, and although I'd got to know Edward Said a bit, our friendship was stopped at that point, because he wasn't someone who was able to take criticism, whereas Ernest, I think, was the kind of man who you could disagree with quite vehemently, and he didn't mind at all.
Yeah. Since you mentioned those two characters, and they're both very eminent, is there anything more about their characters apart from their ability to take criticism, particularly Ernest, because there's an interview with him.
Well, he was another thing he was completely blind to was the feminist movement. I remember an occasion at the AAA when he gave a lecture on, I think it was organised by Adam Cooper. It was really to celebrate the publication of his book, Plough, Sword and Book. And there was on the panel, there was an American feminist anthropologist called Peggy Sande. And in the audience, just in front of me, was a woman who'd just given a lecture, just given a paper on her experience of being raped, which we published in Anthropology Today. And she went on, I think, to become a lecturer in rape studies, which had become a sort of sub-discipline in America. Anyway, it was an articulate and intelligent and very very direct and uncensored description of what it was like being raped. And Ernest Gellner got into a confrontation with Peggy Sande on the panel, after which she said, "Why do you leave women out of your story completely?" And he said, "I like women, but they're not important in the field that interests me." At which this woman in front of me walked out very dramatically. And I went up to him afterwards and remonstrated with him slightly about this, but he just shrugged his shoulders and said, I'm not an expert in sexual abuse. Why should I be? It's got nothing to do with my studies." He just didn't understand the sensitivities of women anthropologists.
Mm. But you liked Ernest?
Oh, very much indeed, yes. I thought he was the most wonderful man.
Mm. A great thinker?
Well, he was very good at... I think he will certainly be remembered for setting out various agendas and so on. He wasn't very, very strong on detail, perhaps. Mm. And he had this sort of sledgehammer approach to linguistic subtleties. Mm.
Was he one of these two particularly concerned with Islam, as you mentioned? And a lot of your current work is to do with Islam.
Yes, I got interested in Islam really by him and Akbar Ahmed, though I think he's become too much of an apologist for Islam, and not really an anthropologist very much anymore, but he got me very interested in this, and a few other people like Hastings Donnan.
Yes. I mean, was it just an intellectual interest, or...?
Well, I think I was alerted by them before the general public was aware how extremely important the relations between Islam and the West were and were going to be.
Mm. What particularly interests you about it? Is it the practical side or the theoretical side?
The practical side of
how to reconcile Christianity and...
I think what interested me particularly from an intellectual point of view is that Islam is an alternative universalism. It sometimes presents itself as a cultural minority in this country, but in fact it is a universalizing movement, so very, very similar in some ways to Christianity in that it is very expansionist and messianic in a way. And I think one can see this in Africa, where whatever is happening in the rest of the world, many countries in Africa are becoming a theatre for the clash of civilizations, with missionary groups on both sides trying to convert people in the middle parts of Africa.
This was really Ernest's view too, that it was a total system. He was attracted by total alternatives to Western system.
He actually wrote quite sympathetically about Imam Khomeini at one point, I think, saying that he respected this man's intellectual integrity, his refusal to compromise. I think he'd have also approved of Ratzinger, actually, Ernest. He liked to consider these total systems.
Mm. And communism, too.
Yes.
As well. I mean, you work now on Islamic charities, and you've written a book about them.
Yes, I've co-written a book about them.
How does this relate to your general interest in Islam?
Well, I've also been, ever since my early days in the REI, I got interested in the application of anthropology to development. People like Lucy Mayer actually had a great influence on me. She was quite an alarming person to work with in many ways, because she didn't pull her punches in any way. But she was put in when I first joined the REI as the academic watchdog, to make sure that I didn't do too much damage to the RI's reputation. So she took this very seriously, and if ever I did anything, uttered a wild generalization that couldn't be supported, she'd come down very hard, which was very good for me. But also her interest in development issues, and I also got to know a number of other people with similar interests, like Peter Louisos and others. And Francis de Souza, who was an anthropologist also. And I was on one of the committees of Save the Children, the Overseas Committee of Save the Children, for some time, and wrote a book called Disasters, Relief and the Media in 1993. So that was an earlier interest in the relief agencies, relief and development agencies, in particular their relationship with the mass media. So in considering what to do next, I decided to look at the Red Crescent societies, particularly because I was interested in why 30 countries have a Red Crescent instead of a Red Cross, which goes back actually to the 1870s and the Russo-Serbish War, when the Turkish soldiers refused to recognize the Red Cross. And since the Ottoman Empire then asked if the Crescent could be recognized as well as the Red Cross, which it was, but this has created endless problems ever since, which actually this very week they're trying to resolve in Geneva with a special conference to adopt a new emblem, the crystal, the red crystal, which is supposed to have no religious connotations.
Mm. Yes, I heard about that.
But this got me on to looking at the whole question of Islamic philanthropy and challenging the assumption that philanthropy is a Judeo-Christian monopoly, because all the world religions have their traditions of philanthropy, which was pointed out by Westermarck very well in 1908 in the book The Development of the Moral Ideas, I think.
Yes,
it's called.
It there.
Yes, which is a good book, but nothing by anthropologists ever since, looking at charity from a comparative point of view in such a comprehensive way.
Mm. I was wondering whether, having read a little bit of this, whether the aims of the Red Crescent charities were really the same. The odd thing about a lot of the Christian charities is that they supposedly, well, not Christian, but the other charities in the Christian world are, that they aim to help anyone of any denomination or whatever, wherever they are in the world. Is there any circumscription? In other words, would you find that most of the charity of the Red Crescents goes towards Islamic society?
Well, the two points, the Red Crescent National Societies as such are non-denominational. They're part of the Red Cross, Red Crescent movement, and they have to be non-denominational. In practice, they are influenced by Islamic culture. But if you're talking about the Islamic charities, which are distinctively Islamic, and putting into practice Islamic values, I think traditionally they were set up to help Muslims or sometimes even to proselytize. But now, under the influence of international agencies and the general kind of trend in which aid and development are going, they are moving, and in many cases have moved, towards a policy of non-discrimination. They would say that there are so many Muslims in the world who need to be helped that they're perfectly justified in choosing countries which have which are 100% or nearly 100% Muslim, but in countries with mixed religious populations, they are now supposed to be moving towards non-discrimination. In fact, what is agreed in head office is not always carried out in the field. Just as in a Christian, an evangelical Christian agency like World Vision, they have made a similar decision not to proselytize in the field. But if you go to the field, you will quite often find people saying, oh, well, those World Vision people, they're really trying to convert everybody.
Mm. What is your own religious?
I'm an Anglican by birth and education. Mm. I think I would say that one should behave as if religious doctrines were true, because I think the consequences of abandoning any religious doctrine completely are very difficult. In fact, I had interesting arguments with Raymond Firth about this, because he believed that you could extrapolate an ethic, a moral philosophy from science, and particularly from anthropology, and I don't believe this is possible.
Since we've got on to Raymond Firth,
yes.
I heard the same remarks made about him by Evans Pritchard, that he was a rationalist and he used to go down and read out selected portions of Malinowski as if this was a biblical text of some kind. This was typical Evans Pritchard joke. But it was, what was, you knew Raymond Firth?
It's said that he was going to be a Methodist preacher when he was very young, because his father was very devout, Wesleyan, as his second name is Wesley. I got to know Raymond and Rosemary Firth really very well with my wife, Zamira. Particularly, well, he was a wonderful friend and ally. He was so old that he wasn't involved in the detail of REI things, so I could go and talk to him knowing that he wasn't going to sort of stir things up at a council meeting, because he didn't attend council meetings. But he was a wonderful friend. But I got to know them both particularly well because of the Cyril Belshaw affair. This was the Canadian anthropologist Cyril Belshaw, who was prosecuted in Switzerland for allegedly murdering his wife, Betty Belshaw, who was a literary scholar, an expert on Catherine Mansfield. And it so happened that he was one of Raymond Firth's favorite pupils. By this time, he was already editor of Current Anthropology and president of the International Union of Anthropological and Ethnological Sciences, so quite a bigwig in the anthropological world. Betty Belshaw, his wife, was Rosemary Firth's best friend. And I was involved in this because at one point, Cyril Belshaw, in a mood of depression, as he said later in his defense, falsified his wife's dental records. She having been thrown off a bridge in Switzerland in plastic bags. And the dental records, for some reason, found their way to my office, because he used our office in London as a poste restante address. And when the police found out about this, the Swiss police, I had a visit from Interpol to ask what this was all about. So I rang Raymond and said that his wife, who was supposed to have disappeared owing to amnesia in Paris some weeks ago, I asked what this was all about. And he said, "You're not really saying that anybody's saying that he bumped her off. It sounds like a very bad Agatha Christie novel." And he simply refused to admit this possibility for a long time. And Rosemary did as well to begin with, but I reasoned with Rosemary around our dinner table that it seemed rather difficult to explain what had happened otherwise. And she had this out with Raymond, and it actually interfered with their marital harmony for some time because they were taking different sides of this argument. And he was very concerned about this, and at one point we agreed to share any information we heard about this from the Swiss newspapers or elsewhere, because he was so concerned. Eventually, Cyril was found not guilty by a Swiss jury, because they had a very slight doubt that he might about his guilt. The evidence they thought was pretty overwhelming. And it was admitted that he had falsified his wife's dental records by filling in some of the records of fillings. But it was very sad in a way, because he was an outstanding man in his way, and he really enjoyed dealing with United Nations bodies and these kind of international organizations, and it set back the influence of anthropology into these intergovernmental organizations by a long way. In fact, it was just at a time when things might have been done and anthropology might have more of a seat at the top table in UNESCO and these organizations.
Mm. That's sad. The other person who's come up a lot is Edmund Leach.
Yes.
I knew him somewhat in King's and elsewhere, and he was a very complex character. How would you play?
He was extremely complex, but if he liked you, he would just go to endless trouble to help. He was absolutely wonderful as a friend and supporter, and he really understood the need to try and get anthropology out of its narrow circles and try and get the message across better. And so he backed Anthropology Today without hesitation through the Esperanza Trust that he set up. I thought it was interesting that he and Mary Douglas got on so badly, because in fact, looking back, I think historians of anthropology will find a lot of commonalities between their ideas.
Perhaps that's why they did.
I think so, because this idea of categorical anomaly, which was fundamental, I think, to both their theories of anthropology, but it was also a gendered matter, because he had a very could be rather bullying at times, and she has, because she's still very much alive and working, has this rather kind of demure manner which sheathes what can be quite a fierce pugnacious personality. But her still small voice at a meeting, and Edmund's bellowing roar was obviously they didn't match very well.
Yes, I mean, intellectually, did you feel that one was won most of the battles, or were they equal opponents?
I think I really wouldn't like to say about that. I think the work on the Bible that Mary Douglas has done in her retirement. People say that this is a major contribution to biblical studies, her study of the circular structure in the Book of Numbers and so on. And I think she's survived in a very, very active retirement. And instead of dabbling with a lot of different things, she could have become a major public intellectual, I think. She was at one time moving in that direction of commenting on all sorts of different things. But she seems to have given that up to concentrate on her study of the Bible, and it's really paid off. And so I think she will always be remembered for that. Mm. Whereas Edmund did give himself up to a lot of sometimes rather superficial journalism, I think.
Another person I'd like your comments on, because he was my PhD supervisor, and you knew him quite well, was Christoph von Führer-Heimendorf.
Ah, yes. Well, I got on extremely well with him, and particularly with his wife, I was very fond of.
Betty.
He was a very good president of the RAI and a very good person to work with. I never found his anthropology terribly exciting as a non-regional specialist, but he was an extremely engaging, original man.
What other anthropologists, major anthropologists, did you know Jack Goody at all?
Not tremendously well. I've admire him very much, but I've never got to know him really well.
Are there any others who you feel had a big influence while you were?
Well, just to take a few names at random, Julian Pitt Rivers, I had a great regard for.
Yes.
And always got on with him very well. I always thought he was a bit of a kind of odd man out, because he didn't really fit in.
Was he an old Etonian?
He was, actually, yes. But his father was, of course, a notorious fascist sympathiser.
Yes.
He really hated his father. Yes. I actually wrote the obituary on him for the article on him for the New Dictionary of National Biography. So I've gone into his career quite closely. Now, I think he was an extremely interesting figure with his very original work as one of the first major studies of a European society in an anthropological context. Mm. And then his work on the bullfight is fascinating.
Mm. So he was another great figure. Did you know Meyer Fortes at all?
Not very well, but fairly well. Mm. John Blacking was another. He died, unfortunately, far too young, but he was a very fine anthropologist, and I liked his ideas on music very much.
Mm. Well, you've obviously been interested in arts and the arts. So
I'm sorry not to have done more when I was director of the RAI on music, but there just wasn't the public in this country. There were hardly very few people interested in it. Mm. I think it's now beginning. Ethnomusicology is now beginning to blossom a little bit more.
What about painting? I mean, people like
Well, he. I think he. Actually, I find his work on technology and magic very interesting now. Mm. Particularly, the idea that what was categorized as sorcery and magic in traditional societies reappears in our societies as public relations and mind control through advertising. I think it's a very interesting idea. And the idea of magic as being the getting a free lunch, I think this can be adapted to all sorts of modern situations. Mm.
And Anthony Forge, did you know Anthony?
Hardly.
No, he was another art person. You were obviously admired the French anthropologists. Did you get to know any of them?
I was very pleased because the very first or second issue of Rain, when it came out, which was just eight pages, rather badly printed in 1974, two of the first letters I got congratulating me on this were one was from Lévi-Strauss and another from Georges-Henri Rivière, the great French museologist. And they both said this is absolutely what we need. So that really encouraged me, because I had to put up with quite a lot of flack from British anthropologists who said, what's all this about, etc.
Mm. And what about the Americans? Were there any Americans you got to know well? Apart from George Appel, who you might like to say something about?
Yes. Burton Benedict I got to know pretty well. And, so many in sort of, but never quite as well as the British ones.
Mm. And George Appel, you...
George Appel, I must say, is strikes me as the ideal anthropological donor. Having tried a lot of fundraising for the RAI, the only really successful fundraising came from anthropologists, because Edmund Leach, of course, going back to the Seligmans, who were early benefactors of the RAI, then there was Edmund Leach with the Esperanza Trust, which was extremely important, then William Fagg, who I also got to know well, but he left his whole estate to a fund for what was the RAI Library and associated activities. And the last of these during my time at the RAI was George Appel, who sent me a fax one day saying that he wanted to spend some money on urgent anthropology and had been turned down by all the relevant associations in America, and was the RAI interested, and I jumped at it, and that has that resulted in the Urgent Anthropology Fund, to which other people have contributed, but it was really his doing. And I think it was wonderful to find a benefactor to whom one really didn't need to explain the importance of what I was trying to raise money for.
Well, there was another question. I think you mentioned you'd like to say something about anthropology as pseudo-religion.
Well, I wouldn't say pseudo-religion. I'd say...
surrogate religion.
I would say that in a secular society, a secularizing society, there are various forms of organization or movements which come to take the place of religious movements. And I'd go back to Erich Fromm, who was, of all the psychoanalysts and members of the Frankfurt School, he was the only one who was really sympathetic to religion. He said that all human societies need to have a frame of orientation and an object of devotion. And Clifford Geertz has said that the one thing people really can't stand is the idea that life might be meaningless. Therefore, you have to have some kind of a substitute for religion when the religious hierarchies are beginning to be eroded. And I think anthropology, certainly in its more popular forms, is an example of this. I'd say that the conservation movement is another. The animal rights movement is another. And anthropology, well, it has quite often been likened, perhaps rather frivolously, to a church, with the idea of fieldwork being the blood of the martyrs and so forth, and the apostolic succession of the in which every anthropologist looks back to his tutor's tutor's tutor and so on. But I think perhaps more seriously, one can see quite a lot of commonalities.
Do you think the fact that, as Evans Pritchard once said to me, that Cambridge had to choose as its professor either a Jew or a Catholic, you know, since all the great anthropologists were either Jewish or Catholic?
Well, this relates perhaps to the marginality of anthropology, that it's always been, and I fear probably, may be destined to be a marginal subject and should accept this, though I much admire what David Parkin is trying to do at Oxford, which is trying to revive the idea of a holistic anthropology. But as the few people who really understand the epistemological difficulties of a holistic anthropology, of reuniting biological anthropology and cultural anthropology when they are so different in their epistemologies, the few people who really are interested in this and understand it disagree with each other totally, like Robin Dunbar and Tim Ingold, two very outstanding figures, but they disagree on practically everything. So I think that's rather difficult for... But still, going back to this idea of anthropology as I would say a para-religion, but without any pejorative concept, connotations. But if you think about it in the more... If anthropology really wanted to become popular, there would be a big opportunity if it could somehow project itself as being a way in which people could improve themselves in an individual and spiritual way, which I think is what Margaret Mead and certain other popularizers were trying to do. Yes. But the whole trend in the last 20 or 30 years has been rather to adopt rather more cynical interpretations of human societies than hers. But I wonder perhaps whether anthropology might not go back towards valuing the important things in so-called primitive societies more explicitly, and there might be perhaps it might strike a chord with the general public in a way that it hasn't in the last 20 or 30 years.
Yes.
And there are anthropologists like Descola, for instance, who point the way perhaps towards how this might be done.
Mm. For yourself, do you feel that in some ways anthropology, your endorsement of religion wasn't resounding, but you need something to build.
No, I think for a particular personality like mine, I found being attached, even as a kind of lay brother, to an ideological movement which has many, many things in common with anthropology, I found something extremely important for me. though I was actually rather disappointed, I think, that the great claims made for anthropology by people like Sol Tax, who said anthropology can save us, have never been realized because of the very strong skeptical tradition and also a fear of popularizing. As an example of what might have been done, and unfortunately it was not done well, was David Mabry Lewis's Millennium series. I don't know if you saw that. It was about, which also came out as a book subsidized by the Body Shop. But unfortunately it became very sentimental with this idea of tribal wisdom. And the tribal people you saw were all either very beautiful, you're sort of going into the bushes to have sex, or they were wizened elders reciting ancient runes and about the origins of the universe, and there was nothing sort of in between very much of ordinary life, or very little. But I think if that had been done well, that could be an opening for anthropology to become a more popular movement, because I think there's a great thirst for movements which offer something to the individual and at the same time relate to the whole of cosmos, the whole of the cosmos and the whole of nature. I'm influenced here by a French sociologist called Raphael Liogier, L-I-O-G-I-E-R, who has a theory which he calls individual globalism, which is that the quest for individual meaning and spirituality, or what the French call le narcissisme éclaté, is not in contradiction with this concern for the whole cosmos, but is in fact the two things are mutually self-sustaining. But what is eroded is first the traditional religious hierarchies, which are very much on the defensive, and second, national and ethnic boundaries. So I think this is quite an interesting idea, to which anthropology actually would fit very well if it were to seek to popularize itself in this way, in the same way that ecology has.
This could be your next book, Jonathan.
Well, I'm just thinking of it actually at the moment.
You are. you must do it.
I'm thinking of the idea of looking at what one could call para-religious movements.
Well, that would be an excellent book, and I look forward to it on our next interview. I think we're just coming to the end of the
tape.
So, was there anything else you particularly wanted to mention?
I think you've covered everything. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, John.